How'd you like to listen to .NET Rocks with no ads? Easy. Become a patron. For just $5 a month, you get access to a private RSS feed where all the shows have no ads. $20 a month will get you that and a special .NET Rocks patron mug. Sign up now at patreon.dotnetrocks.com.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, guess what? It's .NET Rocks again.
It keeps happening.
It keeps happening. 1,831 times, to be exact.
Something like that.
Buh. How are you, man?
I'm all right. And we're in the grays of winter now, right? You know, we had the cold winter stuff in December, but now it's just rain.
It's just dark and gray.
Rain. Yeah. I mean, rain. In theory, the days are getting longer. You know, we passed that back in December, but it sure doesn't feel like it.
This is why they're all alcoholics in Russia. Because the weather's terrible and it's cold and nasty.
You think the weather's terrible? You should see the politics.
Well, hey, I'm trying to stay away from that. But good God. Yeah. Just, you know, we usually do a Beat the Winter Blues party for our friends and neighbors in February. I'm just on the fence of whether I want to do it or not this year. It's a lot of work, but it is fun.
Yeah.
You know,
less expensive than a trip to Mexico.
That's true. Hey, I got something interesting for Better Know Framework. So roll the music.
Awesome. All right, man. What do you got?
So PWA support on iOS.
Right.
Safari works.
Safari only.
Yeah. Didn't Google Chrome ever work on iOS?
I don't think it ever worked for PWAs because it doesn't get access to Gecko.
Yeah, and they got forced to use WebKit, right?
Yeah, and they don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just looking and wondering why Chrome doesn't support it. And I swear that I thought Chrome supported PWAs on iOS at some point. And then at some point, it didn't.
Yeah.
And so I went to their website and I put a link to it, 1831.pwop.me. And right on Google Chrome help for iPhone and iPad, Chrome for iOS does not support PWAs.
Interesting.
Very strange indeed.
Because Apple.
Yeah, I'm not so sure if they want PWA. I've said this before, you know, that if they're going to have PWAs on iOS, they want to control it.
Well, and that's what they've done, right? They've got, it only works in Safari, so it's up to them.
Right, it's up to them.
Yeah. And it's, you know, is it really an app store thing? Possibly. You know, is it just indifference to an open programming model? Very likely.
Very likely. You know,
we come to expect a bunch of other companies to be open source friendly and so forth. But Apple? Eh, not so much.
Not so much. Yeah. The whole open word, they don't like that very much. They definitely like closed.
I don't think that I don't think they're I don't think anybody said, you know, Linux is a cancer or anything. Like, who would say that? But
who would say that? Did we say it? Then we didn't say that. Did anybody say that?
But they certainly haven't gone out of their way.
Yeah. Right. Well, anyway, that's what I got. It was just one of those what moments that I swear I had used open to PWA on Google Chrome on iOS before. And now it doesn't work.
Yeah, no, I buy that it, one time it did, now it doesn't.
Blech.
But I also think at one time Chrome on iOS was really a reskinned Safari in a lot of respects.
Right.
And so now they're really trying to do it in Chromium. They're running into limitations in the way the iPhone allows access to things, and so it doesn't work.
Blech. Yeah. All right.
It's unfortunate. But you know what? If you're on an iPhone, then you're, you know, believe in the ecosystem, so I guess you're using Safari anyway.
Yeah,
that's what true. A great browser it is.
Oh, it's awesome. We love Safari.
Safari loves you back.
All right. Who's talking to us, Richard?
Grabbed a comment off of show 1823, which just this past December, we talked to Jeremy Miller about Wolverine, the .NET command and message bus, and a bunch of other technologies, too. I mean, we've got a lot of links in that show.
Yeah.
And Bijou Lecure wrote this comment about a month ago. That kicked off a lot of other comments. So, you know, it must have been, at least it's controversial. I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's certainly controversial.
Right.
And B said, great episode. I've been using Martin Rebus and Mediator and looking forward to trying out Wolverine, as it seems to be to replace that combination with an integrated library. And I was giving Jerome a standing ovation during his rant. And that was towards the end of the show when he was talking about architecture. I think he's right on about the clean / onion / hexagon architectures not being the only right way to structure your code. Well, and I think it was Carl who said very pleasantly some time ago, only a Sith speaks in absolutes.
I wasn't the one who said that. I think it was Obi-Wan Kenobi.
That might be true. Yeah.
Yeah.
At least you were quoting Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Sure.
From a galaxy far, far away.
Far, far away. Yes.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
I find that for microservices, these horizontal layered approaches are complete overkill, since it makes what should be simple code that fits into your head a nightmare to work with. Hmm. I don't know. That sounds more like, you know, you're making it more complicated than it needs to be. Hmm. Often layers get short-circuited by junior engineers who get confused in the complexity and ceremony. Now, then that's, now you're talking about a whole other thing there, B, which I think is very relevant, which is, have you got an architecture that your entire team can work in?
Yeah.
And understand. There are ways to vertically arrange your code so that it's loosely coupled, solid, and testable. And Jimmy Bogard has a bunch of videos on vertical slice versus horizontal for some examples. We love Jimmy. That's why we always make fun of him.
I like to slice my vertical pizza horizontally.
If it's vertical pizza, isn't it actually a lasagna? My lasagna has crust. For those that are confused about the rant, I suggest you give it another careful listen. Jeremy is not saying don't use clean architecture or that it's inherently bad. He's saying it's not the one and only one right way, and consider that there are other approaches that might be better for your situation.
Right.
You know, there's sort of an implication here of, you know, architecture versus force. Yagni, you know, like
you
go down that path too. And I add to Jeremy's statements that the moniker clean architecture indicates that anything other than this pattern is not clean architecture. This is not true, and believing so will limit your ability to reason about the right solution to your problem.
We get hung up on definitions, don't we, in the tech world?
Oh, without a doubt. I call them glossary games.
Absolutely. You know,
where it's like, and most of the time the correct answer says, what do you mean when you say?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, there's not absolutely certain definitions. Anyway, I read that comment because I know we've got Steve Smith on, and he cares a lot about clean architectures. And
sure does.
He's also a thoughtful and very moderate voice in our industry.
And let's face it. He's a Jedi.
It's true.
And
he does not speak in absolutes.
He does not.
In fact, I think he has perfected the it depends.
It depends.
The Jedi it depends?
Absolutely.
There's an undergarment joke in here somewhere.
Yeah, I've never heard a Jedi say it depends. But
yeah.
I've definitely heard a Sith say always and never.
Exactly. So, B, thank you so much for your comment. And a copy of Music to Code By is on its way to you. And if you'd like a copy of Music to Code By, write a comment on the website at dynetrocks.com or on Facebook. We publish every show there. And if you comment there and I read it on the show, I'll send you a copy of Music to Code By.
Come to think of it, I think Luke Skywalker said, I'll never join you. So
it's true.
You know, who's speaking in absolutes here?
Yeah, he was a Sithy moment. He wasn't a Jedi yet. Yeah,
that's true. It was a Sithy moment.
It was a Sithy moment.
All right. Well, follow us on Mastodon. He's at Rich Campbell at mastodon.social, and I'm at Carl Franklin at techhub.social. Send us a toot, toot, tooty, toot, toot, tooty, toot, toot, tooty, toot. Somebody actually did send us a toot, and it was, here is the obligatory random toot. For .NET Rocks.
There you go.
So thank you. So let's bring Steve Smith on. He does have a bio, but it hasn't really changed in a long time. Let me read it to you. Steve Smith, otherwise known as R. Dallas, is an entrepreneur and software developer with a passion for building quality software as effectively as possible. He provides mentoring and training workshops for teams with a desire to improve. Steve has been recognized as an MVP for over 10 consecutive years, probably more now, and is a frequent speaker at software developer conferences and events. He enjoys helping others write maintainable, testable applications using Microsoft developer tools. Connect with Steve at rdallas.com. Welcome back, Steve.
Hey, Richard. Hi, Carl. How's it going?
Yo, yo.
All the things, man. All the things.
Yep.
It's been a while since I've been on. I don't know if I even made it on in 2022. I didn't check before this, but it's been a bit.
Yeah, it has. It's been a minute.
I don't know. I think we got to punch your frequent flyer card, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a long year.
It was.
Yeah.
We've had a bunch of long years. No, yeah, you missed 2022. And by you, I mean me. the last was Domain Driven Design in 2021. So now we could do clean architecture in 2023.
All right. Yeah. Here we are.
Yeah.
I have been talking about it quite a bit lately.
You have. We did a clean architecture show in 2018.
We saw at Dev Intersection in just this past year in Las Vegas. And you were talking about something like this then, weren't you?
Yeah. It's been, a frequent topic of mine. A lot of people find it helpful. So that's why I keep talking about it.
Right. So what about this whole always do this, never do that?
Well, the first rule or first law even of software architecture is it depends, and everything is a trade-off. I guess that's kind of two things. Really, the law of software architecture, first law from one of the books I was reading recently, is that everything is a trade-off in software architecture. So,
sure,
if you want to do, you know, clean architecture, which is really just a way of organizing your source code. It's not really the architecture, like from a, you know, how your system is hosted standpoint. There are, of course, going to be trade-offs, and there are going to be times when it is more or less appropriate.
Yeah, right. And it just seems to me that the whole moniker clean architecture implies a whole bunch of things. And, you know, if you just keep it as a goal, you know, to make things clear, to make things clean, to not repeat yourself, to make things the right level of granularity, right? So that some action is not too big and too overstuffed, and it's not too granular so that you have a lot of changes to make when changes come up. I guess that's the whole key, isn't it?
Yeah. And then, I mean, the biggest thing for me that this architecture allows is domain-driven design. Mm. And a big chunk of domain-driven design is what Evans called model-driven design, where you have a domain model that you use to encapsulate the complexity of the business rules or the business domain. And you want that to be isolated from other concerns, other dependencies, like, you know, am I using a database? What database is it? Is this a mobile app or is it a web app? You know, those types of things will probably have some impact on your design of necessity, but you want to minimize them to the extent that you can. And that is what kind of leads to this more loosely coupled architectural approach that lets you keep that model separated from other things.
Right. And that model, the business model, I guess what you're calling, we're not talking about entities. We're not talking about data models. We're talking about a model of a process or something that happens in the business that code-wise is expressed as just pure logic, right?
Yes. And well, yeah, one part of it is something called entities, but they're not entities in the sense of, you know, this corresponds to a row in a SQL database necessarily.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's entities, there's value objects, there's domain events, there's specifications, there could be factories and all kinds of other, you know, patterns and things in that domain model. that are, like you said, just pure logic, right? You should be able to instantiate them and work with them and put them inside of a test harness or write a CLI that works against them separately from your main application that might be in ASP.NET or what have you.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we're still getting naming problems here too, because when I hear you say, well, this facilitates domain-driven design, it's like, so I shouldn't bother with clean architecture if I don't want domain-driven design? Or can I do domain-driven design without clean architecture? Can I, you know, and vice versa? Like, how dependent are these things?
Well, in my experience, and I've been doing this for a couple of years, I like domain-driven design for applications that have some complexity. And if they have some complexity, then I want to write tests for them and have the tests be automated and run them as part of my CI/CD pipeline. And in those cases, I find that clean architecture makes it really, really easy for me to keep my domain model pure and not polluted with other concerns like how am I doing persistence or what's the UI. And that makes it super easy to write those tests. Those tests all run super fast because they're unit tests. They don't have any dependencies. And it's all just, you know, a virtuous cycle for me.
Right.
Where I don't think that you need to be doing domain-driven design, and I think clean architecture kind of goes along with it, is if you're just doing a really simple CRUD app, and there isn't a lot of logic, and you're just manipulating data. And it may be part of the same organization. It may be, you know, this organization has this really complicated thing that they built that, you know, is, you know, this process that you need to make sure works correctly. And then they have this other thing where you, you know, modify all the settings for that same process. Right. But it's got its own UI and it's got an admin screen and some, you know, internal user goes and fiddles with the settings every month once. Like that admin screen with all that CRUD for all those settings, that could be a single project app. You could just, you know, scaffold that thing, just point it at the database and grab the settings or whatever. Like do the simplest thing you can with that. But the other one that's really complicated and you want to test the heck out of, that might be a more of a candidate for domain driven design.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it does seem like a threshold of complexity, right? Like at some point, and maintainability. If this app's going to be around for a while, if somebody else needs to work on it, these seems to be all things that would make my life easier as the new person coming in on a project.
Yes. Assuming that you are able to learn the practices or conventions that were used. And that's true of any project. But if you're coming into the project that uses the clean architecture template that I have on GitHub, it's only got three projects. You know, there's folks, even Jeremy that you mentioned earlier in the show, you know, at the end of his last episode, he did a little rant against clean architecture. He's like, oh, we don't need these six or eight different projects. Like, it's three, right? It's not that hard. And, you know, one of them is just all that business logic and separated into its own project. One of them is the UI, which you're going to have an entry point into your app. And then the third one is just all of your out of process dependencies, mostly being, you know, data access and these days web services that you're calling out to.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that complicated.
No. How retrofittable is it?
In which direction?
Yeah, I mean, meaning I've built a spike, I've built an initial rev of an app, we've gotten to a certain point, and it's gone from a temporary project to ship it and make it run for 20 years. Now I'm like, right, probably need some architecture.
That's true.
And what usually happens is some consultant comes in to do a code review or something, and they say, oh, no. This we need to go clean on this. And so now you're, you know, refactoring. Can you refactor a dirty application into a clean architecture?
I think one of your comments on the Jeremy show, somebody said something about not liking clean as the name because it implies that any other architecture is unclean.
Right. Right.
But yeah, that's like agile too, right? Nobody wants to be clumsy. So of course we want to be agile, right? But to answer the question about how would you refactor or retrofit from, let's say, a single project solution, you know, very simple without any, you know, project-based separation of concerns into one that does separate concerns by project, it would not be very difficult because you're just pulling things out into their projects. And if you've, you know, got dependencies going where you shouldn't, then you'll have to fix that. But yeah, that's the whole point of the separation is to give you that separation. The one that's harder is if you have a layered architecture that's going in the wrong direction with the dependencies.
Yeah.
And so that was a super common approach, what we would call N-tier architecture from 20 years ago, right, where you'd have your UI and your UI would, you know, new up and call your business layer objects, and they would in turn new up and call the data access objects, which would then call the database. Now that architecture, because you have to invert all those dependencies, is a lot more work to convert to a, you know, more dependency inverted clean architecture style of you know, organization.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where the longer you wait, the harder it'll be.
Yeah, and you can do it incrementally.
Right. So, I mean, this is no different than it's very reasonable to start with a fairly large, with a service object blob, and then realize later, hey, it's best if we carve off this set into an independent microservice set that can scale separately from the rest of the blob.
Yeah. The problem becomes when you have all your logic behind button clicks and, you know, mingled in with the UI and, you know, in methods that don't really describe the big picture, that are just sort of, you know, hyper focused on doing a technical job, you know, and then somebody comes in and tries to refactor it and move it around, and oof, it's a nightmare.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I am a fan of working in vertical slices. That's something I've been promoting and talking up for a very long time. And folks want to set aside clean architecture on one hand and this so-called vertical slice architecture on the other, as if they're opposed. But even when I'm building stuff using the clean architecture project organization, I still deliver features in vertical slices, meaning from the UI all the way through the business layer, all the way through the database, through all the slices of, you know, the places the logic might have to go in order to perform the work of a given request. And basically it's feature driven, right? A vertical slice correlates to a feature, completely across all layers. And that's how you should be delivering value to your customer, as opposed to horizontal delivery where, you know, your customer gives you this project that they, you know, expect you to get done with in 6 months, let's say. And you spend the first 3 months building the data access layer. And then you spend the next 3 months building the business layer. And then you spend the next 3 months building the UI. Oh, wait, we ran out of money. Like that doesn't work well.
Yeah, but it's never worked well, actually, right?
No, like, it never has. But yeah, but some folks do it. Like that's how some teams or deliver.
It's I don't know if some or do they believe they should, right? It's like we need to build all of the things.
Yeah, I mean I think it varies a lot with the organization, obviously, but I have seen projects fail because they didn't ship anything the user could use or find any value in. And they ran over budget while building things that weren't shippable.
Right.
That were ultimately would be necessary for the full scope of the project if they ever got to the full scope of the project, but they didn't. And so when they ran out of money, they didn't even have something to show somebody.
Right. By Mr. Smith, are you talking about compromising architecture because of financial means? Where's the purity in that?
No, I'm suggesting that fast feedback is the most important thing you can do.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's a really valid and important point. It's like odds are you're not building the right thing anyway because the customer didn't really know what they wanted. Mm-hmm. Like the sooner you get bits in users' hands, the sooner you start getting the feedback that actually builds value.
Exactly. Yeah. So the tighter those feedback loops are, the faster you get back some feedback on the code you're working on today, the better. Because there's two ways that we fail as software developers. We build the thing wrong or we build the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is usually the more expensive mistake.
And arguably more likely.
Oh, yeah. Communication is hard.
Because that translation layer between the domain expert, the person who's going to use the thing, and you is the hardest part of the job in most respects.
Yep.
Yeah.
The sooner you get stuff, but that's very much an agile thing. The point of clean architecture seems to, I'm not going to say more abstract, but it's like, it's about how am I going to be able to keep responding to their needs over time because of the stuff I build tolerates being modified.
Yep. And that's the goal, right? And it's easy to refactor and easy to have confidence in your code because it's so testable. So provided that you're actually writing those tests at the unit level and mostly at the unit test level, and then for things that have APIs, which is most of what we're building these days, at least in the teams I'm working with, it's super easy to write integration tests for your APIs in .NET Core or .NET 7. So, you know, write those two kinds of tests, and you'll have really high confidence when you go to refactor things and make changes that it's going to work.
Mm.
Yeah, and again, we get into bringing a new person into how long it takes to get a new person up to speed. What I love about these CI/CD pipelines is you don't have to remember to run the test. You don't get to build it without it.
Right. Yeah, and you know it's ideally you're just given a repo and you pull it down and you say .NET run .NET test and you're good to go. If it's more complicated than that, there should be a script that you run that says you know build. But locally, you should be able to have everything work locally without you having to go and install a kitchen sink worth of dependencies. Like that should also be something that's done as part of that build script, as part of that initial setup from the repo.
Right.
And nice. Docker really makes a lot of this easier these days because you could just do a Docker compose and it grabs all the dependencies it needs.
If your YAML is right.
That's right.
And are you finding containers the normal way to deploy these things these days?
Not always for deployment, but definitely they're helpful for building in the local environment if you do have dependencies that you don't want to depend on all the time. So,
right.
You know, in production, you're using Cosmos DB or using some SQL Server in Azure, but on local, you could just spin up a Linux container that's SQL Server and populate it with some sample data, and then you're off and running. Of course, if you're running on Windows, you can use SQL Express, but a lot of teams are polyglot and don't necessarily have all their devs running on Windows, but everybody can run Docker. So, you know, if you make that the de facto standard, then it works everywhere.
Gives you your sort of neutral approach to everybody can make a working self-contained development environment.
Yep.
Mm.
Yeah. It's an interesting part of this.
Yeah. The number of environments that we deal with in modern software is generally larger than it was, you know, 10 or 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a point that I think a lot of people miss when we start talking about dependencies and the need to, you know, invert and abstract those dependencies away, like the database. So if I were arguing with somebody 10 years ago about, you know, hey, we shouldn't depend directly on a database, a common argument back would be, oh, but we're never going to, you know, realistically move off of SQL Server. So there's no reason to abstract away from it. Whereas today they might still think that and they might even be right, but it's not about whether or not in production we're ever going to move away from SQL Server. It's about, well, what are we going to use in stage? What are we going to use in test? What are we going to use in dev? What are you going to use locally? Like all those things could, for whatever reason, want to use a different version of the persistence layer.
Yeah.
And even with SQL Server, I mean, there's so many flavors of that up in the cloud. You might decide you want to use Cosmos DB instead of SQL Server directly, which still operates as a relational store. So it's less of a foregone conclusion that you're always going to be on one data store these days, I think, than it ever was.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And multiple data stores and data stores for different purposes. Like data is just showing up more places now. And the joke is it always has been. We were just generally abusing SQL Server.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. There's some folks that find SQL Server to be their magic hammer and everything looks like a nail, right?
But that's also because the DBA demigods required it.
Oh, sure.
Right? Like it was very hard to get rights to store anything anywhere else.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, if your position in the company is, you know, your primary responsibility is to make sure we don't lose any data, then, you know, that's your motivating factor and not is everybody using this tool appropriately for the application involved. Right. So that's sometimes you're going to have consequences for how you incentivize people in your organization.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you get to store anything anywhere at all. You do have to generally, if you're going to place the responsibility for the care and feeding of that data on other people, you should tell them where it is.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I'm definitely seeing these days, and I think cloud's a big enabler of this, that there are more storage choices that a company is comfortable with.
So coming back to clean architecture,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that I hear people complain about is the number of files and places you might have to go to touch something in order to implement a feature. And I wanted to, you know, address that for a moment. I see some folks building things in, and especially demoware coming out of Microsoft with like minimal APIs, where they literally just put all the logic in program.cs with a Lambda for, you know, a middleware handler. Mm. And I don't think that's necessarily the right way to be building actual enterprise software. And I don't think Microsoft does either.
No, I agree.
So, you know, if nothing else, you're going to have all kinds of Git conflicts when your entire application is in program.cs for anything right. non-trivial. So we should probably use more than one file. I think everybody agrees, for non-trivial software. And if you're going to have multiple files, it might make sense to have, you know, a file per endpoint, logically, that the app is exposing if it's a web app, whether that endpoint is a page or a web API. Most of the time, like I said, it's web APIs these days. So I'll create an endpoint, for each of the endpoints of the application as a file. And then that endpoint's going to have some contract, right? It's going to have a request and a response. And so I use what I call the Reaper pattern, which is request, endpoint, response as an acronym. And I'll put the request and the response really, really close to that endpoint. Sometimes I'll put it so it's chained in Visual Studio. So when you hit the little plus icon, those two things are with it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll put it in the class itself, right? If it's only ever used by that class, that those DTOs might live in that class. But they're additional files, right? And they probably should be, because they're the data contract for that particular endpoint. So we're up to like two or three files now, assuming that you needed a DTO for coming in and returning back from this endpoint. And now it needs to talk to something to do logic. Mm-hmm. And that could be a service, could be like an application service or something like that, or it could just work directly with your domain model. And I'm a big fan of working directly with the domain model. That's why we spent all that time making that cool domain model that represents the business, is so that we could use it. And I don't think it's an abuse to use it directly from the web APIs or the UI layer. Sometimes I will create application services if they need to do a lot of translation to, you know, view models or other DTOs or things in the UI. But a lot of the time it's fine to just work with the customer entity or what have you. And so now you are going to do something with that, and there's going to be logic there. So whatever that entity is, you'll have that file to deal with. Right. And you'll, you know, do whatever operation there. And that's about it.
You know, the difference here, Steve, is that when you're building it, you add one file at a time. When Yes. you load the template, all the files show up at once.
There is that. And when you're the new person on the project, oh, wow, there's all these files, right? It's more than just the template. The template's not that bad. But, right. you know, one of these things that's been there for 2 or 3 years, there's going to be a lot of files.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's just a matter of the tooling, right? I mean, try to look at a 1,000 project solution in Visual Studio and find anything.
Right. Well, yeah. Projects is a whole other thing. But I would submit to you that it will still just be probably like three projects, but it will mm-hmm. have a lot of files in it. And I think some people just prefer mouse wheel driven development, where, you know, I'll take a couple giant files I can just spin my way through than having to actually, you know, navigate to things.
I'm changing the name of this show right now.
Spin my way through mouse wheel. That's great.
Yeah, that's right. I have a CS file called Do Stuff.
That's that's the show name right there. Yeah. Right there.
And with that, I got to interrupt for one moment for this very important message.
There is always something new from our sponsor, Text Control. As a developer, do you need to integrate PDF generation, document editing, or electronic signatures into your ASP.NET Core or Angular applications? Or you want to learn more about the differences between electronic and digital signatures? Text Control is offering a free consulting service to educate you about digital document processing and how Text Control products can help you add these features to your applications. Go to textcontrol.com/contact and request your free personal consultation.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we're back. It's .NET Rocks. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Carl Franklin.
Hey.
Talking to our friend Steve Smith about mouse wheel development.
Mouse wheel driven development.
Yeah. Some of those developers, they just like to spin their wheel.
Geez.
Sooner I can get away from that, the better.
Yeah. I, all this time I've been working so hard on, I have a big enough screen so that all the code in that class fits on the screen.
Yes.
You know, that shorter and those separations make my life better, that they're all
oh yeah for sure
single purpose, and the code can be held in your head.
Oh, I thought you were saying you'd got a big enough screen that you could have a big class.
Oh, no. 2160 high is important, man. I guess I'm not saying I got my classes that short. Goodness knows.
Yeah.
2160 high and the toolbar on the left.
Right, right. So you get those extra pixels down.
Every pixel matters.
Yeah.
Maybe I should just rotate in, you know, give in and rotate into the vertical position. I saw a guy all but straddling a vertically oriented 49-inch curved screen. Like, it's as tall as you at that point.
Yeah, the curve is meant for looking at horizontally. There's no reason to have a curved vertical screen.
Yeah. Curved and vertical. I don't understand. But that, you know what? That's a lot of lines of code.
Actually, you know what? Maybe you could stack like three of those side by side.
Side by side, get the same width.
Hey, as long as we're like, just BSing frivolously, I saw this great toot today. I said, "Hey Siri," and then farted. And then my phone started playing a Toby Keith song.
please.
Oh, come on. That's funny. And completely off the beaten path. So let's get back to what we were talking about.
We were talking about getting three 49-inch displays all rotated vertically side by side. So
that's what you were talking about.
That would be very similar to the look from like a cockpit of like a helicopter or something.
Something like that. Plus that whole, yes, dear, I needed to spend $5,000 on monitors.
That'd be monitor-driven design right there.
There you go.
I don't know how many. You're not going to need the mouse wheel anymore.
No. What I'm waiting. I guess I'm expecting eye tracking now because – do you do this? Do you just like look at one window and then look at another and then start typing and, oh, geez, my focus is in this window? It's so easy to do.
Yeah. You know, one thing I miss on the Unix machines I had way back in college was that wherever your mouse pointer was over, that's where your keyboard, where your key focus was. Right. So like in Windows, you have to click on the window to be able to type in it. But
yeah, have the focus.
And at Unix shell, all you did was just mouse over it and you could just type there. It was nice. And you could still be focused on the other one for whatever that meant, other than typing, I guess. Speaking of shortcuts and tooling, though, I think it was Richard said right before the break, is that the tooling needs to be there to make it so dealing with a whole bunch of small files works well. And that is absolutely true. And it used to be that if you didn't have ReSharper, you were just going to be hurting to develop things this way, because it had a lot of really nice shortcuts and tools. Visual Studio has come a long way in catching that. And specifically, the tool I use constantly is Control T, because you can search for anything with that, whether it's a type, whether it's a file. And the really nice thing you can do, too, is when you're doing that kind of search, just use the capital letters in the thing you're looking for. So if you have some, you know, customer, factory, builder, pattern thing, you can just be like CFBP and it'll find it. Like, you know, assuming those are the capital letters.
I didn't know that.
The class. Yeah. It's been around for a long time. And it's really nice, right? Cause a lot of times you do have these somewhat longer names to be descriptive. Mm-hmm. If you have a certain business thing that is an employee or a customer or a product, it's going to have this and that service and this and that repository and a, you know, factory and other related validators and what hat. But yeah, if you just type the first character, it's really quick to find.
Yeah. That's cool.
Wild. Okay. Yeah. And that's, and then there, and it speaks to good naming conventions too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That helps for sure. The other thing that makes it so you're not having to look all over the place for the files is organize things around those domain objects.
Right.
So if your whole thing is about working with, let's say, employees, then, you know, there's an employee aggregate, which is another domain-driven design pattern, that would be in the root of your core or domain project. And inside of that, that would be where the related entities and specifications and validators and anything else, you know, all of those things would be right there. And so you're not having to go to a bunch of folders called specifications or entities or whatever. Like, don't have your folders be generic pattern names. Have your folders be the features or the core business aggregates that you're dealing with instead.
Yeah, it sounds like most everything you want to start at the core project for the most of the time. When do you use the other projects?
Well, if you have some new dependency that you didn't have before this feature that you're working on, then you would put that dependency in the infrastructure project.
Right.
So let's say that I've built this thing and it's starting to work and, you know, I've got some, you know, for me, my default is just use EF Core and And map it with that. And so I'll put the DB context and the configuration files in infrastructure pretty much from the start. But then later on, let's say that this particular application needs to send email and I'm going to use SendGrid for that. Well, then my SendGrid, wrapper class that's going to know how to talk to SendGrid and know how to look up my SendGrid keys from config, that's going to live in infrastructure. I'm going to have to write that before that feature is going to work.
Right.
But I can write everything else about that feature and test it as long as I have an interface, like I send email or I notification service or what have you. Mm. I don't need to wire up SendGrid until production.
Mm. Right.
But in the meantime, I can be testing with a local mail server or whatever else. And I frequently do. So any type of external dependency, that you need for a particular feature, you need to put that in infrastructure when you create it. But first create the interface that you're going to use, to work with it. The other thing, of course, you need is whatever UI there is, you're going to have to build. So whether that's an endpoint, you can use the Reaper pattern and create a single endpoint with a request and or response that goes with it. If you're building actual, you know, Razor pages or whatever, then build, you know, the Razor that goes with that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing front end development, that's usually a whole separate project anyway. And oftentimes I'll be doing that in VS Code with, you know, VS Code's tooling for Angular or React or whatever, but that's right. A whole separate thing from clean architecture, right? Mm-hmm. That's a whole different client.
Mm. Yeah. And it makes the point that these are complete separations of concern because you do have a web project, but that's generally just for ASP.NET Core, right? Like MVC.
Correct. Yeah. Not for any of the front end stuff. Now, mm-hmm. if I was doing Blazor, then I would have Blazor project also. And usually I will put that in the same project as the back end just for, you know, ease of development.
Project, not same solution.
Same solution. Yeah. The right. Blazor project, like I'm usually doing WebAssembly and then I'll maybe have a shared project where I can share types, right? Mm-hmm. So those two projects would be in the same solution as my backend API, my infrastructure, my core, but they wouldn't have to be, right? I just do it as a convenience. You could certainly have the Blazor stuff be in its own separate solution and have a whole different team working on the front end with the APIs being elsewhere.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it seems this is all we end up building this anyway. The only difference here is you have a set of templates, so fewer mistakes.
Yeah, I mean the other thing that people complain about when you do hexagonal or clean or whatever you want to call it, this separation by project, is that the dependencies of the projects make it difficult or actually impossible to do certain things, right? So because the infrastructure project depends on the core or domain project, mm-hmm. There is no way in core to new up a DB context if it's in infrastructure, right? You can't get the reference, right? I'm sure you could do it with reflection, but you can't, you know, at compile time with strong typing, just instantiate a type from that project. And that's by design. That's a constraint that keeps you from shooting yourself in the foot. And you know, there's folks that don't necessarily need that and they're going to do the right thing because they're awesome developers and they don't make mistakes. But, you know, there's also a reason why we have things like variable scoping, even for the really smart developers, because, you know, you don't want to have to remember all the time that you might have used a global variable.
Right.
It makes it a lot easier if you only have to worry about a scope inside of a limited area.
So this is more of a pit of success mindset. You're going
totally.
If you're going to do that external dependency, you're going to do it in the infrastructure.
Hey, but if you're a JavaScript CSS programmer, you're used to everything global anyway. So what is this typing you speak of?
Even JavaScript's got some local scopes.
Yeah, it does now.
I love working with Blazor because the component model lets you scope JavaScript and CSS. Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is nice.
It's nice. And long time coming.
Yeah.
Right. So Richard, you hit it on the head when you said the pit of success. That's the whole idea. You're just trying to make it so that the right thing is easy and the wrong thing is hard. Mm-hmm. And there's ways to get around it if you need to do something, you know, in a particular place. But by default, you should do the easy thing and it'll force you into that pit of success.
Right. And if you have to struggle with it, you know, that sort of makes you take a step back and go, am I doing this the right way?
Yes. And it's the right way for this particular project and the way this project is organized, right. not Visual Studio project, but, you know, this application, right? It's not to say this is the only right way to build software. I'm not coming across like that, I hope.
Yeah. No, there isn't one right way, but this is a debate that you've had with development and architecture all of the time, which is architecture puts forth a set of ideals about how we're going to organize and maintain things. And then we press against it to say, I am impaired this way. am I, you know, is the development wrong or is the architecture wrong? Like, where do you right. make concessions?
Right. Yeah. And, yeah. And the idea is you want with an architecture or with a framework or platform, you want to make it so the simple stuff is easy mm-hmm. and the hard things are possible.
Right.
And so you, if you've got something that's really complicated that kind of goes against the grain of how things are organized, you should still be able to make that work. But by default, everything should kind of be laid out in a way that the, you know, the 80% case of what you're building is pretty straightforward.
Right. And yeah, and that's as much as you can hope for. The 20% is always hard. It's just a question of whether 20% is heroic
right.
or darn near impossible.
The way that I organize the stuff in, you know, my DDD projects is I leverage this pattern called specification, which mm-hmm. not too many people are using. Mm-hmm. But Carl, you and I talked about that the other day. Sure. And you're using a version of that in your templates too.
Yeah, repository.
And basically what it does is it encapsulates query logic into a class. And then that class is not coupled to entity framework. And so it can live as part of your domain model and you can test it. You can give it a good name. You know, so you can have a class that's named something like, you know, the, premium customers with past 6 months orders. Right? That's a specification. And so you didn't have to write a big, you know, 5 lines of link code that dropped into a controller somewhere. And then, you know, nobody ever sees it again and somebody copy pastes it and hopes it's right. Like, no, you've got this thing in a place that you can test it and it's got its own name. And you can reuse it. And consequently, the data access layer, as it were, is one generic repository that takes in these specifications and you don't ever have to touch it. So, you know, folks that want to say, you know, I don't want to work with this architecture because things are all split up. And every time I do something, I need to change this, that, and the other, and, you know, touch the data access layer. Like, no, you don't. Like, I never touch the data access layer. It just works.
Right. Yeah. We definitely have to do a blazer train on that. I thought my repository library was pretty evolved. And then you were like, oh, how about this?
I include a link to the Eric Evans and Martin Fowler, you know, PDF on the specifications pattern. But it's like, hey, you know,
it's pretty cool.
Martin Fowler is one of our best thinkers in software development, and Eric Evans, the father of DDD, like, this is probably who you should be
probably reading from. Yeah,
exactly. Now, they didn't know anything about Entity Framework, but the nice thing about using specification with Entity Framework, at least my implementation that I have on NuGet, mm-hmm. Which is called ardalis.specification, is it works directly with it because of the way EF parses expression trees from the lambdas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it builds the SQL for you without you having to have your own translation layer. Now, it's not quite as nice if you're doing Dapper or some other data access technology. You're going to have to do some more work to write some of those queries yourself or come up with your own mapper. But in the case of EF Core, I mean, it works really nicely.
And you mean Dapper, D-A-P-P-E-R, not Dapper, D-A-P-R, because, you know, names are hard.
Yes, the OG Dapper, not yeah. the ones that came later and decided to try and use the same name as something else for no apparent reason.
Dapper is a wrapper around ADO.net.
Yeah, yeah. It's a distributed application PR stunt. I don't know. I like DAPR, but I wish they'd come up with a better name that was not a collision.
Yeah, it's just, I have to call it out every time yeah. now because I keep getting confused on it too.
Yeah.
You know, it's too easy.
I started this YouTube show, which I'm going to talk about probably in the next episode, where I teach a chef, a professional chef, what programming is and what it's all about. And he stops me all the time. He's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I said, you know, we're just like, if you don't know what we're talking about, it must sound like we're speaking, you know, Klingon or something. It's just yeah. like it's you have these surreal moments, you know, like somebody walked up to me once and said, hey, have you heard of cucumber? And I'm like, yeah, and just made a Greek salad. I put some cucumber in there. Tzatziki, right? And it's like, you know, all the names of things and the inside words. And I guess that's why people listen to podcasts like this, but it can seem surreal.
Yeah. I mean, if you told someone that this was a programming podcast and that people should, you know, listen to this programming, you know, and they knew a little bit about programming, they'd be listening to me like, all right, but I didn't hear him talk about an if statement or a for loop or, whether or not to put a semicolon there. Like, we're not talking it even at that level,
right?
Which has its own jargon.
Yeah.
Well, it's this place where it's like, actually, I have to build software that helps people that I can keep maintaining. You know, the amount of 10 plus year old software I'm finding in organizations these days, it's staggering. Mm-hmm. And the architecture matters. The testing infrastructure matters. Like that's how that software doesn't become a weight on the organization.
Mm. Yep.
All right.
That brought the conversation to a screeching halt. Yeah.
We're there, you know, we're talking about the thing. Talk about the shared kernel project, because I know we talked about infrastructure and web and core and so forth, but shared kernel is a little bit different.
So a shared kernel in DDD terms is this thing that two or more applications have agreed to share as far as abstractions or types that they're using. Hmm. And you're only supposed to change it if the teams on each of those sharing, you know, applications agree to the change. And so some things, you know, sort of are easy candidates to put into a shared kernel, like your base types for things like your base entity or base value object. And that way you don't have to, you know, copy paste that code everywhere that you're going.
Right.
And so that's all that is. And my recommendation is always to make that an internal NuGet package dependency, and then you can version it. So if you have two applications in your org that both have these shared types, and then one of them needs a breaking change, the one that needs the breaking change can just rev it to, you know, NuGet package version 2.0, and ship. And meanwhile, that other team with their application that isn't ready to deal with that breaking change because they were about to ship also, they can just ship on version 1.0, right? So as opposed to using a shared source approach where it's, you know, everybody gets the change immediately, having that NuGet package makes it so it's less tightly coupled and easier for both teams to keep independence.
Now, the hard one then becomes 3.0, which is 3.0 just a modified version of 1 to skip 2, or are we actually going to incorporate the changes of 2 to make 3, you know? And I'm just talking about two teams fighting over shared tooling.
Right. Well, and like I said, hopefully there's no fight because they both should, in theory, have to agree before any breaking changes happen. But
yeah,
that all is going to come down to office politics.
Well, and I've done enough bus work where we had 4 and 5 versions of APIs still running.
Well, yeah, at the same time.
Yeah, all at the same time. And just begging for, can we turn off 1? No, still 1 thing on the bus, still depending on 1. No sign of them updating.
Right. And that I would put in a different NuGet package. I'm a fan of internal NuGet packages for organizations. I don't think that gets used enough. But what you're talking about, the message contracts, I would absolutely put into NuGet packages. They wouldn't necessarily go in shared kernel, but they would go in some other package that at least the sender and the clients, or you know, the publisher and the subscriber or the sender and the recipient, would consume those packages. And whoever owned the message would be the one that was responsible for revving the NuGet package. And I'll even go so far as to say that, you know, if you're the one that owns the API that other people are calling, then you would also generate a client that is compatible with your current version and publish that, you know, so that all your clients don't have to manually talk to you over HTTP, you know, directly. They can just call, you know, the API that you expose through this client instead. And that's just being a good citizen, you know, of publishing these internal APIs for the rest of your organization.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every time we're talking about a battle that happens over multiple versions, and anybody just working on the current version or the first version is wondering why we're worried about this stuff, you know?
Right.
You have to get to a certain point of pain or have been to a certain point of pain before you're like, oh no, we need a little more formality around all of this.
Yeah. At the very least, include version in your messages as a property of the message so that later on you can always do a check and inspect and say, is this the version that I think it is?
Yeah.
And that I know how to deal with? Because at some point it will probably change. Yeah. The best place to be with API versioning is where you're building a SPA and the SPA is the only client of your API and the two ship together. Then versioning is easy. You know, you can version all day long and it doesn't matter because you only have one client.
It's true for like a month.
Right.
And then
right.
It's not. Then there's a fork somewhere. Oh, no.
Yeah. You got to lock it down so nobody else can get to that API and just, you know, even if you have to use the backend for front end pattern so that, you know, there is an API that corresponds to that front end and nobody else knows about it or can authenticate to it. And maybe you do fork your backend APIs to support other people. but that it's separate from that back end that the spa uses.
Yeah, these are great problems and just in a constant battle.
Steve, do you teach programming courses in this stuff? You know, if somebody wants to learn how to do things the Steve Smith way.
Yeah, so I have a small team at Nimble Pros, nimblepros.com, and we do mentoring and training on domain-driven design and clean architecture and moving to the cloud or moving to .NET Core, .NET 7. A lot of our clients have existing .NET 4 applications that they built over the course of 10 or more years, right. And they're trying to figure out how to move to, you know, the modern stack. And that's what we're good at. That's who we're mostly helping.
That's very cool. I might actually take you up on one of those. That sounds like I'd learn a lot.
Yeah, anytime.
Yeah.
Well, and you teach those workshops at Dev Intersection on a routine basis, like, and they're full.
Right.
Like, lots of folks come out to those things.
Yep.
I don't know. I could give you in return, maybe guitar lessons.
There you go. Yeah.
And I'm talking about GITTAR, guitar.
I'm not familiar with that one.
So what's next for you, man? What's in your inbox?
At the moment, I am just, you know, looking into 2023 and hoping it's better than 2022. You know, working on courses and have a long list of updates that are behind on my open source projects and things like that. So mostly open source and other products is what I'm thinking about. Mm. Look for some updates there from me this year.
Yeah. Do you have any projects you do for fun, just for your home use?
Not a whole lot. I mean, I like other people using my stuff. And for me, the number of people that are going to use it is usually like one. So it's not that exciting to me. Yeah. So I'd rather just go buy something off the shelf for like home automation and things like that. Yeah. So most of my time I'm putting into, you know, open source NuGet packages and things like that.
Very cool.
That, you know, I see a few million people use, and it's like, ooh, that's cool. I did that.
Yeah. Did we miss anything? Is there anything else that you want to cover before we say goodbye?
No, I think this was a good show. I hope people learned a little bit about clean architecture and know when to use it or when not to use it. And, you know, keep delivering things as vertical slices, even if your architecture isn't, you know, doesn't say vertical slice in its name.
Right. Very good. Good advice. Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure as always.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Richard.
All right. We'll see you next time on .NET Rocks.
.NET Rocks is brought to you by Franklin's Net and produced by Plop Studios, a full-service audio, video, and post-production facility located physically in New London, Connecticut, and of course in the cloud. Online at pwop.com. Visit our website at dotnetrocks.com for RSS feeds, downloads, mobile apps, comments, and access to the full archives going back to show number one, recorded in September 2002. And make sure you check out our sponsors. They keep us in business. Now go write some code. See you next time.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.